Okay, folks, well, we're ready to go on with our history lesson then this morning. And where we got to yesterday was essentially through the first generation. And my slide stuff here, as I said, is a work in progress. And so I change all of these things, but I'm just going to have to flip through this real quick this morning. We talked a bit about what we're not talking about, where, in case you're here for the first time this morning. We're not talking about what the Church of Christ is. That is a biblical topic. So we're not studying what has happened to the Lord's Church. We're talking about that in the evening. But rather, we're talking about just one historical movement. It's not my denomination, because I don't belong to a denomination. Now, some of these people behave quite denominationally sometimes. But I don't have any defense for that. And it's not a morality tale about what people should do. So when we talk about what's happened in the Restoration Movement, I'm not commending all of it. I'm just saying that's what happened. All right, and we talked about the value of history. I don't need to tell you that again. Then, let's see, I'm just going to flip through. We talked some about the antecedents and said that there are a lot of folks We're not the first ones that ever thought of this idea. Many people have had concepts of restoring New Testament Christianity. And so we had a first generation of people who, from around 1800 to 1865 in the United States, preached this message of restoring New Testament Christianity. And phase one of the movement I talk about is between 1800 and 1865. By 1865, most of the first generation leaders were dead or were died shortly thereafter. And then this morning I want us to talk about the second phase in the history of the movement from 1865 to 1906, in which three kind of distinct religious communions come out of this group of people who set out to restore New Testament Christianity. And then what we'll do, David Holder made this slide for me. I can't doctor it any. But at any rate, after 1906, the Churches of Christ kind of have their own distinctive history, and we'll talk about that later on. I still don't know how to make this chart, told you yesterday, where we ended up yesterday, is that as I study Restoration history, I essentially divide the 200-year history of the movement into five periods. The first period from 1800 to 1865 of that first generation leaders. The second period that we're going to talk about this morning, which it goes from 1865 to around 1900. Actually, it goes further than that in some respects. In which you have the kind of sorting out of people into three quite separate religious communions, in which we can, I think, properly call some of them denominations that grow out of that, and others who still have an undenominational concept of what they're trying to do. Then a third period, if you can imagine, my whole chart, which I'm going to try to figure out how to do, is with a single line for the first generation, and then forks out into three lines. And then the Christian churches, they have their own history. Then if we pick up the history of the Churches of Christ again, and I have a single line during the third phase, from 1900 to 1950, Churches of Christ actually grow quite rapidly. We'll talk about that. Then in the period from 1950 to the present, what has happened is Churches of Christ have separated into three actually quite distinct fellowships that have very little association with one another. And that has more or less been completed, I would say, by the year 2000. It takes place in stages, and we'll talk about those stages and how that happens. Since about 1960, non-institutional Churches of Christ. Names get kind of tough in talking about this movement. In the first division up there, in phase two, there's kind of the good fortune of people were using three different names. And so the liberal denomination becomes the Disciples of Christ, conservatives in the middle call themselves Christian Church, and conservatives call themselves Churches of Christ. So that was kind of convenient. At the end of the 20th century, we have not had that convenience. And so name's an interesting thing, what you're going to call yourself. A lot of people thinking about that now. But at any rate, what has happened in Churches of Christ is there are lots of different kinds of things that call themselves Churches of Christ today. And they are quite distinct from one another, distinct in ways that we'll talk about specifically later on. That is to say, people go to different schools, people take different papers. You can only preach in certain kinds of places. You can't preach all over the place. And so there are quite real divisions taking place. Now, since 1960, non-institutional Churches of Christ have kind of had their own history. And that's a generational history. And so by Friday, I want to talk about what's happened there, what is happening. Because the interesting thing's happening there. Well, I want to summarize the first period, 1800, 1865. Tell you what happens during this first period is... They grew. They grew quite rapidly. You know, in one generation of people, they baptized about 250,000 people. And that's really quite remarkable. And one can say, well, how did they grow? What made them so successful? And I could say, well, I will tell you, the reason they grew is because they developed this really sophisticated, efficient, denominational central organization. But actually, they didn't. They didn't have any organization. I mean, they established a little missionary society in 1849, but nobody paid any attention to it. And it didn't do anything. They grew without organization. They were just congregations spread all over the place. So that wasn't why they grew. Well, the reason they grew is because they were rich. They had a lot of money. Actually, they were not rich. They were mostly just poor people, is who they were. And so they didn't have that. Well, they grew because they had really sophisticated, highly educated, very talented leaders. Not really. They were mostly just a bunch of farmers. Now, there are a few of these fellows were sort of educated. I mean, Alexander Campbell, the Disciples of Christ, if you go to National Disciples of Christ Historical Society, you would think Alexander Campbell's the greatest thinker of the 19th century. Actually, nobody knew much about him. And he was not that. Who most of these people were is they were just farmer. And farmer preachers. So that's not why they grew. I'll tell you why they grew. And here's Marcus now. I'll tell you why the restoration idea and churches grow anytime in any period. They grew because they were full of people that believed they had a message that other people needed. That's why they grew in the New Testament days. And in any generation, any group that grows, it'll grow out of the commitment of the membership. And I'll tell you something about growing here today. We'll talk about this Friday too. There are a lot of things you can do to grow. And lots of times people say, well, we're going to try some kind of new arrangement to grow and so on, or we got a new formula. Nothing wrong with any of that. But I will tell you, what will work is if you get a bunch of people that really believe it and want to teach other people. That's the only thing it ever has, the only thing it ever will. So that's what happened in that generation. Now, sometimes when we take these periods where I just got one line, we think, well, boy, that was great. Everything was great during those times. No problem. Well, no, a lot of problems, actually. And we always have had disagreements and divisions and debates and contentions. And I want to tell you something. That goes with who we are. If you're just committed to saying, I'm going to follow what the Scriptures say, and everybody has a right to read the Bible, I'll tell you what you're going to have to do. You're just going to have to talk to each other and struggle. Because it's not neat and it's not tidy. Now, sometimes that results in divisions. In my book, I call the period like that a wild democracy. What this movement is, it is a wild democracy. There are proper ways in which we ought to do that. But, now, and I can tell you how to not do that. I can tell you how to not have any disagreements. Make me Pope. Then I'll just stop everything. You can do two things. I mean, you know, this is classic, everlasting historical problem in the history of Christianity. Of that, and usually well-intentioned people want to say, well, how can we stop heresy? And there are two ways that you can stop heresy. Number one, you can organize and say, okay, we've got an authoritative organization, and if you don't teach what I say is true, we kick you out. And so that's what denominations come out of. The other thing you can do is you can creedalize. You can say, okay, we're tired of all this stuff, everybody's saying whatever they want to, so what we're going to do is we're going to write it down, what you have to believe. But both of those just violate the principle of what we're trying to do, and that is to say that every person has a right to go to the Scriptures and study them, has the obligation to go to the Scriptures and study them. So, heresies arise. In the early period, there was a heresy over premillennialism led by a guy named John Thomas, he established a group there known as Christadelphians. I don't know if you've ever seen a Christadelphian or not. There are not many of them. Some of them defected to the Mormons, one of the earliest leaders in the Restoration Movement, became a leader in Mormonism, a guy named Sidney Rigdon. They fussed and feuded about war and slavery. I don't think I'll linger on those things. And they discussed missionary societies and instrumental music as early as the 1840s. And I want to tell you, every doctrinal issue that ever becomes a kind of focus for division in the Restoration Movement is not a focus for division when it immediately arises. Every issue that has ever been divisive has been discussed by a whole generation of people. And missionary societies and instrumental music, people divided about them. Lots was written about it. But people behaved in brotherly ways in discussing those things until other things happened. Okay. Now, what I want to get before us this morning, this is another chart that I just did offhanded on another program and I can't edit it, so it's not very correct. This gets before us what happened. Now let me just talk to you about what happens. In phase one, then, from 1800 to 1865, you had this generation of people who went out preaching the ancient gospel, saying we need to restore the New Testament church. They called themselves different things. They called themselves... Alexander Campbell liked the name Disciples of Christ. You know, I kind of like the name Disciples of Christ. You like it? You know, Christians are called disciples 231 times in the New Testament. It's a good name. That's really what I am. I am a disciple of Jesus Christ. So I like that. And Campbell said, you know, they were called disciples first. That's true. They weren't called Christians until later on at Antioch. But Martin Stone's people and many others just called themselves Christians. And they would call their churches Christian churches. Which, I have to heretically tell you, is perfectly fine with me. That is, you know, the Scriptures do talk about the churches of the saints and the churches of the Thessalonians. So if you know what you're talking about when you say a church is made up of Christians, that's what it is, yeah. More frequently they call their local churches, they call them Churches of Christ, and they did that quite distinctly to say this is an undenominational statement. That we're not Baptists, we're not Presbyterians, we're not sectarian. We simply belong to Christ. And it has had a good impact to call yourself that. It gets a lot fuzzier in the 20th century, doesn't it? Because it's become so denominationalized and sectarianized itself. I was preaching a meeting in Nashville not long ago and reading the Sunday paper on in Nashville and looking at the listing of churches. And here's this long list of churches under Church of Christ. And Then on the next page there was one that said non-denominational, and I said, I might rather be under that category because that's what I am. But anyhow, that's another issue. I won't get myself in more trouble than I need to be. Well, okay. Now here, let me just tell you what happens then. Between 1865, and this is really not finished until 1950, but we'll say up until the 1930s, what happens is these groups spread out, these people spread out, and end up in these three separated communities. The first division, the first group to be spun off, is the Churches of Christ. First group really separated. I put the word conservative in there. I'll talk about those words in just a minute. The date that's generally assigned to that is say that the Churches of Christ were separated from the others by 1906. You know why the date 1906 is taken? In 1906, there was a religious census. The government did a religious census, did four of them in 1906, 16, 26, 36, and then they quit as for fear that it would be a violation of church and state. Separation of church and state. Now, there's a lot of good information in those censuses. And I'm sorry from a historian's point of view that they don't do it anymore because we can't get that information. But anyhow, when they did that, they came through Nashville and David Lipscomb told them that they ought not to count Churches of Christ as the same as Christian churches because they were quite different. And so they didn't. Now, the truth is, you can't assign a date to when divisions take place in the Restoration Movement because there's nobody to declare a division. There's nobody, there's no headquarters and there's, and in fact, this is not neat. They take place different times all over the place. But a division takes place within this movement when essentially people quit crossing these lines easily. Now, by the way, there are never just three focuses. There are people scattered all along this line, actually. But sooner or later, you have to choose where you're going to live your life. You have to live your life in connection with some other people and relating to some other people. So, by and large, that takes place. By 1906, in the census of 1906, there were about 1,400,000 people in this movement. And this movement, by the way, is probably the largest Native American religious movement, either the American Restoration Movement or Mormons. But about 1,400,000, about 125,000, 130,000, maybe 140,000, 10% were in Churches of Christ. And so it's a very small portion. They were called, by the way, they were the conservatives. You know, conservative and liberal are not bad words. Do you know that? Those are words historians use them all the time. They are relative words. They tell you relatively where you stand about something. And I think it's proper to use that in this context, in that the Churches of Christ represented the conservative theological position in the Restoration Movement, in that a conservative is somebody who wants to conserve what exists, to maintain what exists. A liberal is somebody who says that you ought to change what exists, because you need to make modifications. Now, many people who politically think they are conservatives are actually not conservatives. They don't want to conserve what we got. They're reactionaries. They want to go back to Louis XIV. But what a conservative actually is someone who wants to conserve what you had, so that if you take the restoration plea that says, if any man speak, let him speak as the oracles of God, we'll speak where the Bible speaks and be silent where the Bible is silent. It was these people who represented that. And others were more liberal. Okay, now, I'm not going to follow these other groups, but what else has come out of this movement to the present is a middle group all the way over there on the left, which generally calls itself, formally, the Undenominational Fellowship of Christian Churches and Churches of Christ. They're quite frequently known as independent Christian churches. They are reasonably conservative Protestant denominations. They separate, this second separation between the disciples of Christ and independent Christian churches takes place really in the 1930s. It's formalized in the 1950s. So that those two groups have two formal. And both of those groups would, I think, more or less consider themselves denominations today. Certainly the disciples of Christ are. They are a very liberal American denomination. Now, when that division comes, that is the overwhelming majority of the people. And the disciples of Christ, which is just in the vanguard of American liberal denominationalism today, one of the leading ecumenical denominations, has lost a lot of members in recent years, as most liberal Protestant denominations have. The independent Christian church had gained some, actually, from that. But it is interesting, by the way, that when the Church of Christ are spun off, when that separation is more or less formalized, they were known, by the way, they were known as antis, because they were anti-instrumental music and anti-missionary society. And the other folks said, you know, well, they'll die. They're just anti-mission work, and they'll shrivel up and die. And it is interesting that now Church of Christ at the end of the 20th century are certainly bigger than the other two put together. And it's hard to know exactly how many people are in Church of Christ. That's a story we'll talk about later on. Well, that sets up for us the nature of the division. I still don't have my pictures from here on in. There are a lot of famous people. I will talk about some of these people later. You know, President Garfield was a preacher and then college president. Three presidents have been disciples. You know the other presidents? Johnson and Reagan. Don't know that you'd want to brag about it. I just have a few other pictures. Now, let me talk with you about the division for just a moment. What causes this division? Let me just preach for just a minute before that. I got 10 minutes here. So before I talk about what causes the division. Wait a minute. Let me tell you what caused it first. There's three issues that were debated for a long time. Whether it was scriptural to have missionary societies, instrumental music, and whether the pastor system of church organization was authorized. People debated those, they discussed them. And in a way, you can say that the division took place over these issues. However, my argument has long been that the Restoration Movement never divides about issues. Issues are discussed and argued over long periods of time, and they finally come to define what's going on. But that's not really what happens. Rather, what happens is hermeneutical separations take place in the movement. People come to have different attitudes toward the Scripture. And when people no longer trust one another's attitudes in dealing with the Scriptures, then they can no longer stay in the same church. And what happens is people came to hold conservative and liberal views of the Scriptures, and there was a position in the middle. There's always a position in the middle, and I will tell you what that middle position represents more than anything else, I believe, is a traditional position. That what happens is when the time comes that people are saying, look, we're doing things that don't fit with our plea, there will be a group of people who say, well, the plea won't work. And consequently, we'll have to discard the plea. And there are other people who will say, yes, the plea works, but what we're doing is okay, and we're going to convolute in some convoluted way. We're going to find a way to say that this is okay because the true church is the church as of 1900. And we're not going to do anything else, but we're not going to quit doing anything we're doing. And so there are people who will kind of take a traditional view that what we are is we are what we are right now. And so we don't go any further, but we don't go back. All right, so there were folks like that. So people had different attitudes towards Scriptures. Now, I'm going to be talking in the evening a little bit about those attitudes. But part of them are biblical. That is, it's a question of whether you looked at the Scriptures literally, like I did last night, and said, we can find out what God wants us to do. Or whether you take a more liberal view of the Scriptures. There's another side of it, and that is people also come to separate themselves. Some people feeling alienated and separated from the cultures. Other people who want to accommodate their religion to the culture. And I'll talk with you some more about that later. Now, I just got three quotations here that illustrate this change of attitude. Here's what an old conservative guy said, 1885. The only way to sustain Christianity and have union is for all of us to say and believe that all God's statements are facts and truths and that all His commandments are to be obeyed literally. Now, if that's what you believe about the Bible, it'll have something to do with what kind of church you construct. Here's what a guy in the middle said. He said, the Bible contains but few specific details, but it does contain every principle of action the human family will ever need. It assumes the common sense of the race. In regards to the methods employed for preaching the gospel to the world and all benevolent ministrations of the church, Christians have no positive specifications, and they may be governed by general laws and principles applied according to their best judgment. Now, that leaves you some leeway, and you can end up doing something differently if that's what you believe. Here's what one of the liberals said. He said, a principle may set aside an apostolic precept. It may brush aside an apostolic decree. We do that constantly. We follow the apostolic example whenever we like it. When we do not, we depart from it. Well, if that's the way you look at the Bible, then you're going to do something different. Now, so that if somebody comes along and says to me, well, what's the difference between what you believe and the Christian church? The difference between you all is that you don't believe in using organs. They believe in using organs. So that's the difference between... No, that's not the difference. Now, people had to focus on something. Say, well, what is the focus of our difference? The difference is, however, today would be 500 things, 1,000 things. There are all kinds of things that are different because we read the Bible differently. And when people come to read the Bible differently, they do different things. Wonder if I should try to do this morning. I pointed out, I've been kind of the chief author of this concept, but I'll tell you another thing that's happened. These people came to be very different kind of people. You know, I will tell you a question that people could ask about. You can take this and say, well, look, these people were doing so good. They came down and they were unified and they were growing and they were baptizing people. And then all of a sudden they're spread all over the place believing all kinds of different things. What in the world happened to those people? And you want me to tell you what happened to those people? I'll tell you what happened to them. Those people died. That's what happened to them. And another generation of people came along. And it was different people. And that second line there, that's different people. In fact, that's probably the third generation. Now, let me preach my sermon, and then we'll start here on the sociological dimensions of that division. That is, it takes place because the type of people had changed. But if you turn Judges, the second chapter, I'm going to quickly tell you my little lesson on the changes in Israel. In Judges 2, beginning in verse 6, what you have is you have the children of Israel going in and taking possession of the land. And they fought the battles and they drove the heathen out and they occupied the land. And then you got caps through three generations beginning in chapters in verse 6. And when Joshua had let the people go, the children of Israel went every man unto his inheritance to possess the land, and the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua. And all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that he had done for Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres in the Mount of Ephraim on the north side of the hill of Gaash. And also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them, which knew not the Lord, neither yet the works which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baal. I'll tell you what happened in Israel. He said that a generation came along and they fought the battles and they went and took possession of the land and they drove the heathen out. And they served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. And then another generation came along and knew not the Lord and all the mighty works that he had done for Israel. And they did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baal. I will tell you what, every generation does what that generation wants to do. And I believe that just happens in a restoration movement. So over and over again. And I will tell you where we are right now, in case you're not going to be here Friday. There's a generation that separated itself saying, no, that's not who we are. That's not who I am. That I am an undenominational Christian. And a generation of people my age, we had to think about who we were and define ourselves and exactly what we were trying to do. And my generation is going to be gone pretty soon. And I believe Judges 2nd chapter actually talks about three generations. And I'll tell you what, there are all over the country today just wonderful churches all over the country with elders who know exactly who they are and what they're trying to do. But I tell you, in another 20 years, there's going to be another generation to come along of elders who never have known, went through this struggle, who will have to understand themselves who they are. Because every generation is a product of its own experience. And people become different people. We'll talk about that next time. They become sociologically different people. And people are going to do whatever they want to do. You know, you are a product of your experience. You know that? Anybody ever tell you that there's a generation gap? That my children were not like me. My children are a lot different from me. Because when I was young, you know, it was hard. I had to walk 5 miles through the snow down in Florida to go to school. And my dad sent me to the farm, and I had to work on the farm hard. And I didn't have any place to make my boys work. And so they, you know, they just didn't do much. They had to take the trash out a couple times a week, and that was hard. So I was talking to a sociologist one day, and he said, you know, he said, I'll tell you the problem with our society. He said, in our society, we just produce too much. He said, we produce so much that we can't consume it. He said, what we need is to quit being such good producers and become better consumers. And I said, boy, I'm raising some good ones there. Actually, they're good kids, and it doesn't make you much difference. I mean, you can adjust to your society, but I think it makes a difference in God's kingdom. Now, you're going to be a product of your experience. And if you just are there because you're there, and you're there because your parents are there, and your motives are different, and you don't understand the commitment that you've made, and you haven't invested yourself in it, and I'll tell you what, you'll do something different. Because it just makes sense to do something different. And the only person that does what God would have us to do is the person that's committed himself to that, to the service of God. So what happens then is, through the years, things change. People change. Their attitudes change. And so we'll start there next time.
Take about a 10-minute break and then have a chance to do this.